Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGMU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about the health implications of the climate crisis. We'll speak with a doctor from National Jewish Health in Denver. He'll be speaking on a panel on this very topic tomorrow afternoon. Then, students will rally at CU Boulder today to demand that a sculpture honouring Loses of Boulder, the six Chicano student activists killed in car bombs decades ago, they're demanding that that sculpture remains as a permanent installation. After that, we'll hear two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You, followed by Naturally with Brigitte Mars. After a commentary from Jim Hightower, we turn our attention to end-of-life choice. Former public radio personality Diane Rame has dedicated years to researching and advocating for more end-of-life choices. Her new book is When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. We'll hear from Diane and we'll have copies of the book available as a thank you gift. We'll also be joined by Kim Mooney, who has long been my co-host in our ongoing award-winning series on end-of-life issues. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Colorado Governor Jared Polis declared a state of emergency in response to the coronavirus on Tuesday morning. That means that the state can access additional federal funds and deploy state resources. Governor Polis said that one of the main priorities for the state is to increase the capacity for testing.
So that eventually we can reach the point, the sooner the better, where anybody exhibiting flu-like symptoms can promptly get tested. We need more testing because the sooner that we can identify positive cases and hotspots, regardless of the severity of the illness for any one individual, the more effectively we can isolate those who test positive and we can limit and slow the spread of the virus in Colorado.
The state has opened a drive-through testing facility on Lowry Boulevard. In response to the coronavirus, officials in Denver on Tuesday announced that this weekend's St. Patrick's Day parade was cancelled. The Colorado Education Association, the CEA, the state's largest teachers union, has also announced that it is cancelling an upcoming day of action at the state legislature. School districts and colleges around the state are preparing contingency plans for the possibility of closing campuses and working remotely. Right now, there are 17 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the state. A bill to replace the Columbus Day holiday in Colorado has been passed at the state Senate on its third hearing. Summer Taylor has more.
The state of Colorado is on its way in becoming one of seven U.S. states to repeal and replace Columbus Day. For Colorado, Columbus Day will be replaced with Mother Caprini Day as a national holiday on the first Monday in October. Prime sponsors of this bill include Representative Adrian Benavides, Representative Kyle Mullica, Senator Angela Williams, and Senator Chris Hansen, all Democrats. The bill passed out of the state Senate Tuesday on its third hearing, heads to Governor Jared Polis for his signature. A representative of Governor Jared Polis told the Denver Post he supports the measure. Frances Xavier Caprini was an Italian-American Roman Catholic nun. She was the founder of the Missionary Sister of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, a Catholic religious institute. Mother Caprini was the first citizen to be canonized as a state by Roman Catholic Church for her support of fellow Italian immigrants and more specifically orphaned girls. There have been several attempts to replace the Columbus Day holiday. Previous attempts have tried to replace it with Indigenous Peoples Day. Several cities like Boulder have already replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. This will be the first Colorado state holiday named after a woman. For KGNU, I'm Summer Taylor.
The Colorado State Supreme Court is considering whether property owners can be held responsible for mass shootings that happen on their land. The Denver Post reports that the case is revolving around the Rocky Mountain Planned Parenthood facility in Colorado Springs and whether or not Planned Parenthood is liable in the mass shooting that happened at the clinic in 2015 and whether a jury should consider claims that Planned Parenthood knew the risk of an attack and could have prevented the shooting by taking security precautions. This could have major implications and could potentially lead the way for victims of future mass shootings to seek compensation from businesses where they were attacked. This has been denied by courts in the past, most notably in the 2012 Aurora Theatre shooting. An Arapaho County jury in that case determined that Cinemark was not liable. In court on Tuesday, an attorney for Planned Parenthood argued that the blame for the attack lies solely with the confessed shooter, Robert Deer. Three people were killed and nine wounded during the shooting that happened in November 2015. In the weather today, expect sunny skies, highs in the mid to upper 60s, but breezy conditions around the Front Range. Tomorrow, a little bit cooler, highs closer to 50 degrees with a slight chance of some showers coming in later on Thursday. And there's even a chance of some snow coming in on Friday with temperatures dropping again towards the end of the week. It is just coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. Public policy experts and medical professionals are warning that a climate crisis will undermine human health and is in fact already doing so. They're connecting a warming climate with human health issues, particularly when it comes to air quality. There will be a topic on this tomorrow afternoon at CU Boulder, and one of the people speaking is Dr. James Crooks, who is an associate professor at National Jewish Health in Denver.
My field of study is really focused on air pollution and its health effects and how it's driven by climate change. Certain air pollutants are driven by climate change. So what we're seeing already is the temperatures are getting hotter, and so we're seeing the potential for health effects from that. We're also seeing air pollutants like wildfire smoke get worse and worse. Some of that is driven by the climate changing. And we're also seeing that our ozone levels are getting harder and harder to control here in the Front Range. And that is also driven by heat and by other emissions that are also often related to fossil fuel emissions.
So then from a health perspective, how does that impact people's health? I mean, how are we seeing this play out then across the Front Range of Colorado?
Well, so, you know, heat stress, I think, is something most people have probably experienced. But, you know, for certain sensitive groups, people who work outside or exert themselves outside, like farm workers, construction workers, student athletes, they're at higher risk for heat stress and heat stroke, as are elderly people who often live indoors or alone in houses that don't have air conditioning. And particularly if people get really hot during the day and can't cool down at night, that can put them at really severe risk, particularly if they have other health problems that the heat stress is just piling on top of. For other things like wildfire smoke is a combination of, is a mixture of many different kinds of gases and particles, and we have a fair amount of information on certain individual components of wildfire smoke. So we know that small particles are particularly dangerous, because not only do they interfere with your ability to breathe, but they can pass through your lung into your bloodstream and cause inflammation and oxidative stress in other parts of your body, which can then cascade into a heart attack or a stroke if you're at risk of those. And if you're exposed to those particles for long periods of time, it can contribute to the development of heart disease and even other diseases that you wouldn't expect, like dementia, Alzheimer's, even behavioral problems in children. Some of the other kinds of pollutants that are in a smoke plume include things like polycyclic organic hydrocarbons, which are cancer-causing. And then if we go back to ozone, I mean, I know folks in the Front Range probably heard that we are out of compliance with the EPA's ozone rules. As it gets hotter, it's going to become more and more difficult to stay in compliance. And ozone causes significant problems with breathing. People who have asthma are more likely to exacerbate and have an attack that sends them to the hospital. Same thing with people who have COPD and other chronic lung diseases. And if you know, people are exposed to high enough ozone for long enough, it can contribute to the development of those diseases in the first place, and even to diseases like heart disease.
So for a center like National Jewish Health, which is really a renowned institution when it comes to research, but also the treatment of respiratory problems. Are you seeing an increase of people coming in dealing with all of these issues, and particularly when the weather is getting hot, when we know we're facing a very hot summer, when we know we're going to have a stretch of 90 plus degree temperatures, you know, for several days? Have you seen a correlation with the number of people then who maybe are showing up in the ER or showing up in some kind of respiratory distress?
So anecdotally, yes. If you ask people who work at emergency rooms — we don't have an emergency room at National Jewish — but if you ask the emergency room doctors at the local emergency rooms, they certainly notice bumps in admissions for respiratory problems on days when there's high temperatures or high ozone. And I've done a small research project where I looked at our patient population, our pediatric patient population here at National Jewish, and found that their lung function decreases a day after a spike in wildfire smoke. So we know that there is some effect already there, even just for people here in Colorado in the small patient population we have at National Jewish. And many other researchers have studied these issues on a national scale or in larger states and found similar effects.
So when we're having discussions at a policy level, at a legislative level, about how to deal with the climate crisis, or even just how to control the ongoing release of carbon into the atmosphere and regulate the oil and gas industry, we often are bombarded with dollar amounts about the economic value of this industry and the jobs. But what's often missing is the external costs, and often that's, you know, the health impacts of all of this. I mean, is that something that you've noticed? And, you know, what is that like for you as a healthcare practitioner and also a researcher when you see how these discussions and debates are playing out at a policy level?
Well, it's quite frustrating to me as a scientist, because, you know, we want to do the fullest analysis that we can, getting the most details right. And if we're leaving out something gigantic, like what's the impact on health and what is then the downstream impact on healthcare costs, that seems like we're missing a big thing. Especially since there are tools that are very cheap and not that hard to use that can calculate those numbers for us. And to see, you know, policymakers not use the tools that are freely available and at their disposal to get those kinds of numbers, it makes me wonder if they don't know that those tools are there, or they just don't think the health impacts are important.
Where do we go from here then, given the stalemate that we often see, albeit there has been some progress? There was legislation passed last year that's still working itself through the regulatory system here in the state of Colorado, but certainly at a federal level, there does not seem to be any impetus to really regulate or hold back fossil fuel development, or even recognition that the climate crisis is in fact a crisis. So where do we go from here, particularly when we are seeing right now health impacts of all of this?
Our state has been definitely on the side of action in a way that the federal government just hasn't for the past 3 years, and that's very gratifying to see. I think the plans that we have so far for, you know, reducing our emissions have some ways to go to get to our goals, but I'm optimistic that we can hit those goals. I'm not a policymaker, so, you know, the details are a little bit beyond me, but the more we can do to, you know, slow climate change and decrease today's air pollution — those two things we can do at the same time — the better for our health now and the better for our children's health in the future.
And do you see this as further exacerbating the divisions that we have in society? If people are so impacted by air quality and the climate crisis, the more vulnerable populations, but then also people who maybe don't have access to health care, that they're going to be just bearing the brunt, as it were, of the climate crisis?
Oh, certainly access to care is a huge issue and concern. And if we even just look only at heat stress, you know, who are the people exposed to it the most? They're people in blue-collar industries. You know, they're the farm workers, they're the construction workers, or they're elderly people who are often living on fixed income, fixed low income, don't live in air conditioning. So, you know, even just looking only at heat, the possibility of exacerbating health disparities between, you know, wealthier people and less wealthy people seems acute.
Dr. James Crooks is a researcher and associate professor at National Jewish Health, and he will be one of the panelists speaking tomorrow at CU Boulder. The panel is Human Health and Climate Change. Doctors and public policy experts will weigh in on how a warming climate undermines human health. It's completely open to the public and it's happening tomorrow from 2 to 4:30 p.m. at the UMC, that's the University Memorial Centre on the CU Boulder campus in room 235. So that's tomorrow from 2 to 4:30. And if you appreciate that we have these kind of conversations continuously on KGNU, well, we would love to hear from you this morning with a contribution. Local news only happens when the local community supports it. And in response to our community and the needs that we have for reporting on issues like fracking, like the climate crisis, we have stepped into that space to bring you these kind of voices. But we need your participation this morning. We need contributions for local news, a donation during our spring fund drive. Be that caller at 303 449 4885. We're going to continue the conversation around fossil fuel extraction, the impact on health and the impact on the economy, some of the economics behind all of this. That'll be tomorrow evening on It's the Economy at 6 p.m. Antonia Juhas will join us live in the studio to talk about all of this. And Antonia, a regular guest on KGNU. These are regular conversations that we get at your community radio station. And if you would like to support that, you can call us right now at 303 449 4885. Well, students at CU will be rallying today on the Boulder campus, requesting that a sculpture that honours Loses of Boulder remains on campus as a piece of permanent Chicano history. Loses were six Chicano student activists who were killed in car bombs in 1974. Now, the sculpture has been deemed temporary indefinitely. That was the decision made by a committee set up by Chancellor DiStefano. Well, Dana Stamo, who is the co-chair of UMass and Mecha student organizations on campus, told KGNU's Rosanna Longo that Loses of Boulder, well, it's a representation of the history of students of color.
So it seems like the university focuses on temporary solutions rather than addressing the actual core issue. And so having the sculpture here is addressing the core issue. We're showing that history is being preserved. And the way that the university responds to that is very telling. The university seems to think that the sculpture is really only important to Jasmine because Jasmine built it, and then maybe to the few people who knew Loses de Boulder, when in fact, this is a representation of the history of students of color on this campus. We're really trying to highlight that not only by collaboratively building the sculpture together. UMass y Mecha as an organization at CU is the continuation of the legacy that had been created by Loses and the students that Loses had collaborated with. This is something that we have preserved for decades already. And our collaboration on this project, our collaboration at the demonstration, is just showing that, you know, too often students, I think, are separated from faculty and staff and administration at the university. And we're showing that we all need to be communicating actively and working together. And if the administration doesn't want to initiate that process or support us more in that process, that we don't mind organizing on our own to get that message out there and get that dialogue started.
And you organize on your own. And what are the tools that you use?
We work really hard to sort of connect with students and other organizations and other groups because, you know, identity on its own is very divisive. We know that we're stronger together because the university has worked to sort of separate us by that identity, because we're weaker when we're just like, you know, in our own little cluster. But we work really collaboratively. And I think that that's really important, that it isn't just brown students on campus. You know, allies show up for this sort of thing. Black students show up for this sort of thing. Community members show up for this sort of thing. And I think that's a really salient aspect of this whole thing. So definitely we use a lot of group chats to sort of get the word out. Personally, I do graphic design, and so I plug in by making flyers or even like informational brochures so that people who have no idea what's going on can sort of get a quick overview very quickly. We'll do a lot of Facebook work and create events on Facebook to get the word out. But ultimately, it's all of us leveraging our own circles and our own networks to spread the word. And thankfully, we've all found our people who care about these same sorts of issues. So it isn't difficult to run up to someone and tell them this is a problem. And then, you know, they'll be standing next to us the next day. It's really awesome.
Tell me quickly about the event in itself.
We're going to all meet Wednesday at noon in front of the sculpture. So the sculpture sits in front of Temporary Building 1, which is near Sewell Hall at the University of Colorado Boulder campus. So this will be a time to reflect on the sculpture and demonstrate to the university that it has deep personal meaning to every person, regardless if they personally knew the face that is on the sculpture or if they personally know Jasmine. This is a sculpture that's indicative of so much more. And so we invite everyone in attendance to bring flowers, candles, pictures of loved ones, and really show the university that this means more than just six people.
Dana Stamo is co-chair of Umasi Mechas student organizers, who are going to be leading a rally happening today at noon outside Temporary Building Number 1 on the CU Boulder campus. That is where the Loses of Boulder sculpture is, and they're calling for that to remain as a permanent installation honoring Chicano history on campus. It is 8:25. Stay tuned for Make Them Hear You.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. President Trump has recently added six countries to his list of nations facing stringent travel restrictions, a move that will virtually block immigration from Africa's most populous nation, Nigeria, and from Myanmar, where the Muslim minority is fleeing genocide. The No Ban Act would limit Trump's ability to discriminate on the basis of religion in his policies. H.R. 2214, designed to transfer and limit executive branch authority to suspend or restrict the entry of a class of aliens. And Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Eritrea, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. Of these six countries, Sudan and Kyrgyzstan are majority Muslim, Eritrea and Tanzania are about half Muslim, Nigeria has the world's fifth largest Muslim population, and Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar are currently experiencing a genocide, which this ban will make it harder to escape. The ban restricts people who want to come to live in the United States permanently through family-based immigration or diversity lotteries. Representative Judy Chu of California and Senator Chris Coons of Delaware introduced the No Ban Act as House Resolution 2214 and Senate Bill 1123 in the House and Senate to repeal these bans, issuing the following statements. Quote, 3 years after the start of the first Muslim ban, we see and hear the impact every day in the stories of loved ones and families unable to see each other simply because of their religion. Now, doubling down on a failed policy, Donald Trump is exposing the truth about his war on immigrants by deliberately separating even more families. By specifically targeting permanent visas, which are used by families, this ban is looking to do what the first ban is already doing, keep families apart. And, of course, we know that America has the ability to safely vet visa applicants because we've been doing so for years. That is why we need to pass the No Ban Act immediately. This bill will repeal the president's Muslim ban and change the law so that any future ban must be based on evidence. I'm encouraged by Speaker Pelosi's announcement that we will vote on this bill soon, and I look forward to finally limiting the president's authority to enact such cruel policies. President Trump's decision to expand his discriminatory Muslim ban not only abandons U.S. values and tears families apart, it is a grave foreign policy mistake. Targeting people from countries where pluralism is just taking root makes it more difficult to promote democratic values, encourage economic development, and attract talented people from all over the world. We must pass the No Ban Act to end this senseless policy and ensure our foreign policy and immigration policies are built on our values. And thoughts on the No Ban Act, H.R. 2214, or Senate Bill 1123, you can share them with your senators or congressperson. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
And it's time now for Naturally.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. Anyone who knows me knows that one of my favorite herbs is nettles, Urtica dioica, or Urtica urens. There's a few varieties of it. Nettles. You know, the Latin name Urtica in Latin means I burn, and you may have found, if you've ever had to retrieve a ball or walk through a patch of nettles, that it stings you. Yes, it's true. Nettles actually contain formic acid, which gets injected into you when you brush up against the plant. And formic acid is also what gives red ant bites and bee stings part of their sting. But we know that nettles also inject salicylic acid and acetylcholine into us. So the good news is that when you cook nettles, when you dry it, when you puree it or blend it in some way, it doesn't sting. So if you drink a cup of nettles or take nettles in capsules, there's not going to be any stinging. However, it is a traditional folkloric use that I find very, very effective, that getting stung with nettles, a technique called urtication, is really good for things like arthritis, helping to improve circulation, to cold hands, cold feet, for MS, for any painful area of the body. It's going to increase circulation of the area. But again, that's not for everybody, although we do think nettles urtication is profound. But when we ingest nettles internally, it's one of the most alkalinizing herbs. It can help the body acclimate to high altitude. So if you have relatives visiting from out of town, you might go to the health food store and look for a product like chloroxygen, which is basically nettle juice, to help them be able to tolerate going up to a higher altitude. So nettle is great for its iron source. It's wonderful for people that are anemic. It is wonderfully strengthening for the kidneys and bladder. It is somewhat diuretic and has a cooling effect when you internally ingest it. It is an amazing plant. The root has long been used for prostate health, and the seeds of nettle as a thyroid tonic. So nettle has been used for alkalinizing the body, promoting fertility, and I really consider it to be a superfood, even more nutritious than spinach. But again, you don't want to eat it raw unless you're game for getting your mouth stung. So nettles juice added to smoothies. When my grandchildren come over, I blend nettles into Pamela's gluten-free pancake mix and make green pancakes. Nettles is a superfood, so nourishing, so energizing. You might want to think about growing it. One nettle plant that was transplanted into my yard 40 years ago has provided multitudes of meals. I now have like 10,000 plants, and we make juice out of it. And it makes you feel like a superhuman. I like that. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
Brigitte Mars and Naturally coming your way as it does every Wednesday morning here at Community Radio KGNU. And if you're a fan of Brigitte Mars and all of our local news programmes, won't you show your support right now with a contribution at 303-449-4885.